If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and a reality check you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio. The Fourth Estate is RCR's newest discussion panel, where our host and guest cast a critical eye over the New Zealand media. Today's host is Alistair Harding, with panellists Peter Williams, Judge David Harvey, and Emeritus Professor John Rain. It's time for the Fourth Estate.
Today's a special day because today we're introducing a new regular show to the RCR lineup. It's called The Fourth Estate, and it's RCR's newest discussion panel, where each week we cast a critical eye over the New Zealand media. And right now, as of this moment, you're listening to our very first show. My name is Alistair Harding, your host for this week. And today on The Fourth Estate, we'll be looking at all the recent news from the media industry, which, of course, this week is led by the news of the closure of News Hub and TVNZ's cost cutting. All up, it's going to mean over 350 journalists out of work. And with those stories in context, we'll also be looking at the digital news bargaining bill and some of the reasons why the media is today in peril in this country. We'll also have a look at the media attacks on our Prime Minister's housing allowance, the Stuff hit piece on the work we do here at RCR, and possibly the strangest story of all in the past week, the media reporting, or lack of it, on the seemingly open and shut case of a young man who was caught punching a 70-year-old woman in the face and got away with it. In short, we've got a lot to talk about. And to do that, I'm joined with me today by a panel of three. Firstly, Peter Williams, legendary veteran Kiwi broadcaster who began his career in the early 70s and has almost worked his way pretty much through the entire media yellow pages. More recently, an RCR host, and even more recently still, a very skillful operator of both ride-on lawnmowers and golfing irons. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Alistair. Very nicely put.
Also with us, we've got David Harvey, former district court judge with a special interest in media law. And I also hear you've advised the likes of Peter Jackson on his movies, which explains all of the Oscars. So welcome to the show, David. You're obviously the one bringing the epic genre to the show.
Thank you, Alistair. Very kind. A nodding acquaintance with works of literature apart from media law. Yeah. I don't know which I prefer the most. But...
And finally, John Rain, Emeritus Professor of Engineering, who's held the role of both Deputy and Pro Vice Chancellor at three different New Zealand universities, as well as involvement in a number of parts of the New Zealand research sector and a frequent contributor to Bassett, Brash and Hyde. And currently, I understand you're living part of the year in France. So if Peter's bringing the golf clubs and David's bringing the epic storytelling, that means you're bringing the champagne.
Thank you, Alistair. Good morning, all. Yes, a good bottle of wine I will bring.
So, as with all good rounds, let's start with a meaty par five, and let's start with News Hub's closure and TVNZ's cost cutting. Peter, I'll start with you because you're the veteran broadcaster here. You've seen all of this from the front row. There are over 350 journalists looking for work this weekend. Have we seen anything like this in this country before, and what's your reaction to it all?
Nothing on this scale before, Alistair, but I was just thinking yesterday as the news came out about a 10% reduction in the headcount at TVNZ and a 10% headcount reduction, rather, in the headcount in the newsroom. We've certainly been there before. There was, I think, at numerous stages in the last 25 years, and certainly in the last 20 years of my time at TVNZ, there was, it seems, always some kind of redundancy round or restructuring on the table. So this is absolutely nothing new. The intriguing thing about the 6 o'clock news, the rumor being that it could be put to half an hour instead of 60 minutes, that was talked about as long ago as, 2005, only 10 years or so after the news hour started. Previously, of course, it had only been half an hour. But the reason put about was that the one-hour show could not be reduced to half an hour because of the commercial breaks and the commercial opportunities. TV One News at 6 o'clock is the highest rating show in terms of the 5+ audience day in, day out. There is seldom a day in a year when the 6 o'clock news on TV One is not the most watched program in the country. Therefore, you've got 12 minutes of paid commercial time at anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000 a minute. Do the sums over 365 days. Literally millions and millions of dollars are at stake. Anybody who's watched TV One lately will know that there is not much advertising on there. The biggest advertiser seems to be TVNZ Plus. The big retail advertising, the big corporate advertising appears to have disappeared, and that's because the number of people watching has reduced. So what was a commercial imperative, and really solely a commercial imperative, to have a 60-minute news program is, it appears, no longer there. So a reduction to 30 minutes would seem very logical. You put it down to a 30-minute show, you can cut, for a start, your sports staff by 50%. You can cut your weather staff by just as many, and your general news reporting around the country, well, a lot of them will disappear. And that's before we start talking about the current affairs programs, such as Sunday, which is really not current affairs. It's just sort of an opportunity for soft profile pieces and a lot of imported stuff. And then, well, Renews, heaven forbid why that was ever brought into existence in the first place. And the merging of Sunday and Fair Go in terms of production staff, sad, but I think inevitable. But yeah, it's just one of those things. It's part of the scene that the pace is gathering, put it this way, in terms of the restructuring, but it's been going on for 20 years.
And it sounds like it's just bloated overheads that are doing it. David, this has happened at a time when our parliament's debating the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, which would force tech companies like Google and Facebook to pay news sites for their content. You've been on your Substack the last couple of weeks giving your opinion and sharing. I even read your submission that you gave for the bill. Would News Hub have survived if they had that cash from the bill?
No, they wouldn't. And that's not me speaking. That's the chief executive officer of Warner Discovery. He made it abundantly clear that the bill that is proposed wouldn't have saved them. Wouldn't have saved their news their newsroom in any way, and I wonder whether or not a lot of the fundamentals are being missed here. As far as I can see, and I agree with what Peter had to say, what is happening at TVNZ right now is just shifting the deck chairs on the Titanic. The Titanic, that huge monolithic state-owned organization for broadcast TV, still sails along. In fact, what they should be doing is designing a completely different ship for the distribution of content. But that's because, but the problem that we have is that they're focusing solely on content. They are not focusing upon what the digital paradigm, which we are living in now, has to offer. And one of the things that they don't understand about the digital paradigm, one of its qualities is continuing disruptive change. And right now, that disruptive change is hitting broadcast news and the broadcast media, if you like, radio and TV, just as hard as it hit the music industry and the movie industry back in the early 2000s. Now, what they've done is they've adapted. They haven't got it completely right, but they're almost there. But will the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill solve the problem? No, it won't. And I say that for two reasons. First, it's going to introduce a fresh level of state bureaucracy, which we really don't need, and involves enforced bargaining, if you like. And enforced bargaining is a contradiction in terms right from the start in any event, because it ain't a bargain in that case. And really what it is a means of subsidizing television and radio, subsidizing media, from a source other than the government. Now, the government has been subsidizing media and continues to subsidize media through the Public Interest Journalism Fund and a number of other agencies, for example, Creative New Zealand and New Zealand On Air. But what this is to do is to introduce another means of funding altogether, which is to compel the big platforms, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, to pay for the content that they use. Now, the content that they use is gathered by means of aggregation and so on and so forth, and basically is created by the various broadcast and radio organizations and so on and so forth, and is protected, therefore, by intellectual property law. What is happening is that the platforms are free ride on this in the same way that there was free riding of music and free riding of movies. They called it piracy in those days, back in the early 2000s, outfits like Napster and so on and so forth. So really what should be looked at, and what has been available for some time, and what the media people seem to have completely ignored because they're looking at the government for help, is copyright. And there is a method of licensing their content so that these platforms pay a licensing fee. Now, that would recognize the reality of what's going on, the fact that it is intellectual property that we're talking about, and it involves an existing structure. There is no need for the Fair Digital News bargaining law. Oh, they say it's too hard to do this. Yeah, sure. But news media, print media, was doing it years ago. This I know because, in fact, I presided over a case involving a copyright licensing scheme for print media. So it isn't completely unknown. And I think that shows the main fallacy. What everybody is looking at, Ian Taylor was on the record, I think, yesterday, saying the government should be doing something. No, it shouldn't. The government shouldn't be doing something. The government should leave it to the marketplace. And the marketplace, including provisions for intellectual property, will take care of it. There's a piece in the paper this morning, I've got it up on my other screen right now, where Helen Clark talks about possible restructuring of the media and so on and so forth, but is looking still at the monolithic model, still the Titanic continues to sail. There is another proposal, of course, which may be privatization. And that might be a way of getting the state out of the broadcasting area altogether. I haven't sort of thought that one through yet, but the state has had an interest in broadcast since the 1920s, 1930s, and one wonders why.
Great question.
There's a few different things in there that I'd like to come back to in a few moments, especially about the adaption part as well. I mean, we're living through the information revolution, the digital age, and they don't seem to be adapting, But to bring John into the conversation first, John, one of the sayings that we've heard a lot over the last week through the News Hub and TVNZ stories is the phrase, go woke, go broke. It's something that's been written about a lot, and I think you've written about it a lot as well. How much is this infatuation with the woke cause is the cause of what's been going on?
Alistair, I think this is something that should be looked into much more closely. I think it's easy to simply react, and we've heard Winston Peters talking about loss of public trust in the public media. And I think that to some degree, certainly older viewers have tended to switch off TVNZ, stop watching. They felt that it is coming through with a single narrative rather than a balance and impartiality, which I think is extremely important in a state broadcaster. And then you've got the younger viewers, and maybe you might look at under 50-year-olds who generally are getting their news from the internet, from social media, and I think increasingly an older generation tends to do that. So there's a commercial angle to that. If the mainstream news source is losing the viewers, then the advertisers are going to be more likely to fall away. And I don't have the expertise to even comment on that, but it seems to me that there has been a sort of a cultural overlay that is affecting this whole situation. Certainly my own inclination to start blogging was over frustration about the lack of media examination of some of what was going on in the sector where I worked, and I won't go into that right now, but I think this issue of what balance we're seeing and what is presented to the public is extremely important, particularly in a state broadcaster.
We had Todd Scott on Paul Brennan's show during the last week, and he talked about how he's the owner of the National Business Review, and he talked about how he's banned opinion pieces and he's invested in high quality journalism. He invests in journalists. He puts everything behind a subscriber wall. And I also remember when I first started in the media industry, the big story or the big conversation in the newsroom was, with the internet age, with the digital age, are we going to be still keeping on going with the free-to-air advertiser-driven model or go down the subscriber route? Has Todd Scott's approach worked and maybe the clickbait version has not worked?
Well, I was surprised, Alistair, to see that Todd Scott was offering, and he's advertising for an editor at the moment. I think he's about to make an appointment. That place must be doing reasonably well, because he was offering an editor's job at a salary of, I think, between, I'm sure I read this correctly, between $160,000 and $170,000 a year. And I thought that was an extraordinarily high salary for the editor of what is essentially a digital publication. So he seems to be going okay using his model. But of course, the newspaper industry at large made a fatal, fatal mistake around about, well, when did I first get the internet dial-up? I think about 1995, when I was still living in Upper Hutt. A fatal, fatal mistake by giving their stuff away for nothing right from the off. I mean, who in their right mind would give stuff away for nothing? You still had to pay, what was it, 50 cents a day to get the Evening Post or the Dominion delivered in those days. Why give the stuff away for nothing? But they did. And that was the big mistake they've made, a mistake, frankly, from which they've never been able to recover. It's way too late now. They're desperately trying to find some other revenue model. Display advertising doesn't cut the mustard. It's got to be subscription. I think NBR is onto something here. Stuff with the begging bowl out? Don't think so. What New Zealand Herald's got a paywall. They seem to be doing okay, but that's got to be where the growth is. They've got to get their people, like with Netflix, like with Spotify. You've got to get your people to cough up subscriptions. I suppose Sky TV was the first one to do that in this country. So that's got to be the way to go. Display advertising isn't going to do it unless it's advertising with a click-through type of model.
The other part of that too, that what you're saying reminds me, is when David was talking about the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill earlier on, the thing that bewilders me a little bit is that if that was the case, if that bill did go through and these tech companies were supposed to start paying for it, wouldn't they do what Facebook just did in Australia and just cut it off? That would seem to be, that's what I would probably do if I was them. I mean, I could understand if they were copying and pasting the news stories onto their own news sites that this might be an argument, but what they're doing at the moment, they're actually amplifying all of these news sites. So isn't that the fair trade-off, the fair deal that's going on?
They're aggregating, Alistair. They Google and Facebook and the various other Microsoft aggregate content. They troll the net and they get the stories and then they just put them up and then you click on them and you link to the original publication, which means that the eyeballs go onto the advertising that's associated with the original publication in the first place. This is one of the reasons why the copyright model has a little bit of difficulty and probably might require a tweak to the statute, but that isn't too hard. But it fails to understand the reality of what is going on. What they see, or what news media sees at the moment, is that Facebook and the others, the platforms, if you like, are making a bundle of money out of their advertising, which isn't just associated with news. It's associated with a whole lot of other activities. They understand what the digital paradigm does and the promise that the digital paradigm has.
But isn't this just a case of the world is changing, and it's changing very quickly? I mean, we're seeing this happen with media all over the world. Last year, it was reported that 20,000 media jobs were lost around the world. We've seen stories recently, the Los Angeles Times laying off 120 workers, I believe it was, Time magazine laying off staff, Vice Media ceased to exist, Sports Illustrated's gone the same way. It goes on and on and on. And I always go back to, for instance, the protest in Wellington. You know, the media turned up with about 6 to 8 cameras, stuck them on the balcony of Parliament and thought they were going to be able to tell the story. But the reality was that all the protesters turned up. Every one of them had a phone. There were literally thousands of cameras. This is the new paradigm that the media is working in today. They're not the only channels of information anymore. Every one of us is a channel of information, isn't it? Aren't we?
Well, that's exactly right, Alistair. But if I can pick up on what John was talking about and the sort of institutionalization, if you like, of postmodernism and critical theory, and focus upon a particular example. John Campbell came in for a bit of flack a little while ago because he put up an opinion piece on TV One News webpage, pretty much along the lines of lamenting the fact that the people of New Zealand had voted the way that they voted. And he came in for a considerable amount of criticism there because they said, oh, you're not being objective and so on. So forth. So after this, he gets an opportunity to have his say. And he writes a little essay that appears in North and South. And in that essay, he says, and I'll read it, in journalism, every headline, every photo, every guest is chosen by someone. Every editorial, every letter to the editor that's published or not published. The time slots guests are given on morning radio programs. The tone of the interview, the number of interruptions. The guests on political review panels who may or may not be radical. It's all human. And to pretend otherwise is to promulgate a myth of objectivity, a myth of objectivity. Mm. His words, not mine. That's most convenient to the status quo. So he says, journalism is subjective. Everything about it is subjective. It's a human process. Well, sorry, John, it's not the way it works. I worked in a business where you had to be objective. You forced yourself to be objective. For 32 years, I went into court every day, had to be objective. If I was subjective, I was not doing my job. I would say to juries, do not allow sympathy and prejudice to color your judgment on this matter. You can't be objective. Get a life, Campbell. Of course you can.
I think that's a fascinating insight, David, and I've never heard anybody put it like that. But then, after all, who has to be more open-minded than a judge? The answer is probably nobody. Could you put that message to your Supreme Court colleagues, by the way?
One of the problems that I have, Peter, is that because of my past role, although I have a right of audience and I have my practicing certificate, I don't do court appearances, but I can still write about them.
Yes, but I think that was absolutely fascinating. The myth of objectivity. I'm sorry I gave up reading North and South a long time ago, but for that particular phrase to make it into print really just goes to show where modern media has gone to. I mean, we could say that RCR looks at life from a right-wing perspective, but so what? Somebody's got to offer a bit of balance in this world, don't they? And I like to think that I can consume across the spectrum. Heaven forbid, every now and then I even open Martin Bradbury, Bomber Bradbury's daily blog. I don't quite know why, because that is just lunacy on speed, but it's still valid because it is the ravings and the rantings of one particular man, in my opinion, as mad as they are. But it's all part of the great spectrum of opinion, the great spectrum of view, and that's the way the world should be, surely.
And just coming in there quickly, Peter, subjectivity is a key plank of the postmodern movement.
Yeah.
And if you look at social media, it's the sort of absolute realization of this.
I've just had a message, and I'm looking at the Herald website. It appears that Sunday, Fair Go, Midday, and Tonight are going. And I think, too, it looks like, and Helen Clark, who's always good for a comment, says the cuts are disgraceful. But that's the latest. They've cut content.
you cut content, you cut people, and that's really what it's about. And as with all businesses, people are the biggest cost.
Alistair, one comment I'd like to make is that I feel that the way in which the media have sort of lurched in one direction, and I mentioned earlier the lack of balanced critical appraisal in some issues, I think that has been a real issue around looking at what's happened in the education sector and the infusion of a tremendous amount of the postmodern thinking, some absolutely bizarre things that have been taught to our young people. And there's a critical need right now to get that investigative journalism back into areas which have been left untouched by the media, because partly, I think, because of the Public Interest Journalism Fund, but possibly simply because of an inclination not to go there because it doesn't suit their own political views. And I don't know whether my colleagues here feel that that's important, but it has been really a key driver for me in the last few months.
The Public Interest Journalism Fund has taken its toll on the trust in the media, hasn't it? There was the Horizon poll last year, which I'll never forget. It showed that 69% of New Zealanders actively avoid the news these days. And a lot of that, I know Winston Peters has called it the product of the Public Interest Journalism Fund. How much do you guys think the Public Interest Journalism Fund has contributed to this lack of trust?
I think it's considerable, but it's difficult actually to find a causal link. Yes. Between, and sorry, I'm talking like a lawyer, but we love things like causation. What it is not so much the fact that we've got provable bias. What you've got is optics. It is not a good look for money to go in the direction of news media from the government, particularly when it is tied to conditions, the first of which involved active advocacy of the treaty and so on and so forth, which was an essential government plank for the Labor government then. So the optics of it were appalling. And although they tried to disguise it by putting a few degrees of separation between the government checkbook and the recipient by making the funding available by New Zealand On Air, the reality of it was that this was a government subsidy. And news media, I think, became dependent upon that subsidy, extra money. And so they cut their cloth to fit the extra dosh. And now the extra dosh is beginning to dry up, which results in the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, so that there's another subsidy that comes into place. And yeah, I think the Public Interest Journalism Fund has had an effect, it's had an impact. Not direct. I mean, we can't prove bias. I know that Winston Peters used that word, but then he's always been a fan of hyperbole. But yeah, it's just not a good look. It's how does it look? And that's something that we always had to worry about when you were looking at questions of bias and so on and so forth. What would a reasonable person think about this? And, you know, government money coming into broadcasting and then all of a sudden a particular line coming through and all of a sudden anybody who disagrees with you is a conspiracy theorist and this, that, and the other. Well, of course, people are going to say, well, I wonder.
Okay, well, how does the media go forward from here? We've talked about subscription models. We've talked about adapting to the digital age. Perhaps if all of these cuts show us anything, you know, 350 journalists looking for work this weekend, you know, that shows that they need to cut costs in some way. They're going to have to do their job a little bit cheaper. What does it look like? What's the future of the media look like in those terms?
Small, regional, and efficient. And as much as I hate to say it, there's going to be a lot more, shall we say, citizen journalism, a lot of contributions which will come in from the general public because of the technology that everybody has at hand with their smartphones. People will be able to shoot vision as it happens. We've got to teach the general public, by the way, to turn their phones on its side, so we get landscape instead of pictures with fuzzy edges. But once the public starts to take pictures of a fire or a happening thing with their smartphones and then put it towards aggregation sites, little small, possibly regional aggregation sites, such as Chris Lynch Media in Christchurch. There's a classic case of the future of journalism, the future of the media. Pretty much a one or a two-man band, makes himself a crust, going really well. He had a reputation and a presence in Christchurch anyway, and he's going well. Maybe more of those will emerge up and down the country. As far as big money and big building outfits like TVNZ, even Radio New Zealand. Well, I suppose Radio New Zealand will continue because the government hasn't got the courage to get rid of that. But TVNZ as an entity, I think its future is not good. And it wouldn't be a bad idea to put it to market to see what it's actually worth. I think they tried to sell it for $1 billion once about 20 years ago. They'd be lucky to get anything for it these days because I just don't think it has any intrinsic value. It's got some assets, some hard assets, but it's not making any money. So why would it be an attractive model? It would take a hell of a corporate caretaker to come in there and try and rescue it. We should also make mention of this news that David alluded to before. Our Sunday is going, Fair Go is going. That's a real surprise because that's been an absolute staple since it started in 1977. As far as the midday news and the late news is concerned, well, I used to be the presenter of both of those at various stages in the past. They've never had huge audiences and are unlikely to ever have huge audiences. Midday was always a very cheap program to put together because it was essentially one or two people recycling news from the morning. The late news, pretty much the same. I mean, I don't believe that you're going to save a heck of a lot of money by axing those bulletins in terms of people in the newsroom. What you will do is cut down on crew costs because you won't have to have shifts across the control room to last as long anymore. And most of those people are working on contracted rates now, so they'll be paid for 4 hours or 5 hours instead of 8 or 9. So there'll be savings in that respect. But I still think we're tinkering around the edges, frankly.
Well, I agree, Peter. And I think one of the things that we need to look at is an entirely new business model. One of the things that characterizes mainstream media is that it still relies on eyeballs on the screen at midday, which they're no longer going to be, and at 6 o'clock and at various other times. It's what I call appointment viewing. And I think that that particular model is going to go. And I think really, if you want to have something that reflects the digital paradigm, you'd have a digital system like TVNZ Plus or something like that, where you have a 24-hour news cycle. And there's none of this, yes, first Jessica, then Tova, so that the TV broadcasters can make their deadlines and so on and so forth, something that we remember from the Jacinda Ardern days. That type of thing, the deadline type of thing, is going to have to go, and you'll have a continuous 24-hour news cycle that doesn't rely on deadlines or anything like that, that is refreshing and so on. I wonder about the idea of promoting stories on a popularity basis, more views per story or something like that. That may not be the most satisfactory way of doing it. But I would think that a distributed news model utilizing digital like TVNZ Plus might be the way to go. And take the programming off linear television. But linear television it's not going to be around in 20 years.
We spend quite a lot of time watching France 24, the France 24 in France, and that has that 24-hour news cycle where you've got regularly updated news, which is interspersed with panel discussions, which are very, very frequent in France, and they're on the mainstream media. Some of them are quite boring, in fact. But I think that sort of model does need to be looked at as well. And I think that it's a very widespread, of course, overseas.
Yeah, expensive to produce, John. People have suggested a Sky News New Zealand model or a CNN type model in New Zealand. That's very expensive because you're talking control room, you're talking staff, you're talking about resources in the field. What we've got to do is basically have a television version of a newspaper website, which sort of updates itself. There is stuff there always available for viewing, a little bit studio based, a little bit raw footage based. How it actually comes together, I haven't thought that through, but I think that just getting back to the Chris Lynch model, that might be some way of thinking about the future of media. Not too personnel intense, because people are the big cost, and relying more on more and more on general public, the general public contributing their video and their pictures. That this is the television television model anyway. As far as the newspaper model is concerned, the written media is concerned, I honestly don't know. They've been giving their stuff away for free for far too long. It may just be beyond repair, and they're just going to have to, frankly, keep on scaling down and down and down.
Okay, let's move on to the news of the week. Let's start with Christopher Luxon. He's been claiming accommodation allowances for a mortgage-free property he owns. I actually think the media is right in criticizing him for this one. What do you guys think?
Oh, heaven forbid. So you're asking him to pay his own rates and body corporate? And his, I mean, let's say that Premier House is not fit to live in, and a report from the Premier House board says it is, the word uninhabitable is not used, but it is not up to standard. So therefore, why should the Prime Minister be forced to live in a tacky, shabby place? Therefore, he goes to an apartment. If he was going to an apartment owned by somebody else, then he could claim the $1,000 a week or whatever it is, and there wouldn't be a problem. But he lives in an apartment where basically he is his own landlord, but when the landlord still's got expenses, and okay, it might be mortgage-free, and Willie Jackson's ridiculous criticism about how it was okay for him to take the money because he had a mortgage to pay, somehow that justified Willie taking his money. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Luxon needs a place to sleep when he's in Wellington. It's $50,000, for God's sake, and it's part of the entitlement package that MPs have for out-of-town MPs. I think he was absolutely within his rights, and he should have done it. Somehow it's become politically unacceptable to do it. He should have had a mortgage. Maybe that was the mistake he made.
I don't go quite that far, but what he's entitled to it, there's no question. So and it was his own place and all the rest of it, and he owns six or seven other places as well. So obviously he's not short of a bob. So I think probably what the best thing might have been was for him to have said, look, I'm entitled to this $1,000 a week, and thank you very much. I'd love to be able to take it, but I don't need it. So we'll just put that to one side, and perhaps those funds can be applied for other purposes. So, the optics of it would have been a little bit better. Yes, I know I can take it, but no, I'm not going to. If he was on the bones of his backside, it might be a different story. But I don't think Christopher Luxon is not. And what is it, 400K he's getting paid?
Well, 479,000 a year is his salary. But David, he should not, as the Prime Minister, I'm sorry, he should not be forced to pay his body corporate and rates out of his own pocket, should he?
I agree. But I think the problem is, what the heck have they been doing with Premier House? I mean, the thing is, it's an architectural disaster for a start. So, you know,
$30 million for renovations come from? Christ, put a bulldozer through it and build something else for about half that, wouldn't you?
John, have you got a point of view to go on with this before we move on to the next one?
I don't think so. I think the other two have covered it expertly there. Thank you, Alistair.
I think I'm going to RCR and asking for an accommodation allowance after this. Okay, the next one is the curious case of reporting the young man who got discharged without conviction for punching the seven-year-old woman in the face. There's two parts to this. I want to ask Peter especially, how is it that the media don't report on this properly? And the other part is, David, from a legal perspective, how on earth did this happen?
Why didn't they report on this? I have no idea. Well, the idea that I have is that Posey Parker was the devil incarnate, and anybody who punched anybody who was supporting Posey Parker is just fine. So therefore, there's no need to criticize anything about the court case. Remember, they were very reluctant. The police were very reluctant to even bring this young guy to justice in the first place. They were just going to let him get away with it scot-free. So in essence, this was the media taking sides in the whole Posey Parker visit fiasco. taking the sides of the then government and the sides of the police. And that particular attitude towards Posy Parker has carried on through the reporting of the case.
And David, how did it happen? How does the judiciary put out a decision like this?
Okay, there are two things behind this. The first is the discharge without conviction. So where a person's charged with an offence and is found guilty or pleads guilty, the court may discharge the offender without conviction. And there's a certain test there. And the test says that the court must not discharge an offender without conviction unless the court is satisfied that the direct and indirect consequences of a conviction would be out of all proportion to the gravity of the offence. So that's the first side of it. So there's got to be a disproportionality aspect to the consequences of a conviction. Now, because of the way in which this case has been reported, we don't know what the judge's reasoning was for coming to the conclusion that the direct and indirect consequences of the conviction would be out of all proportion to the gravity of the offence. Now, one of the things that the media prides itself on and waffles on about when it comes to name suppression, I'll get onto that in a moment, is that, we're there as the surrogates of the public to make sure that justice is open. Well, I'm afraid justice isn't open in this particular case because we don't know why what happened actually happened. So that's the first area where things are deficient. Now, I understand that the young man in question was a first offender. He had certain difficulties of a personal nature. But beyond that, I don't know and I can't recall anything that I saw reported which suggested that the consequences of the conviction for an assault, which was, you know, relatively serious, would be out of all proportion to the gravity of the offence. One of the things that judges do when they go through this analysis of proportionality is that they classify the offending. So you have low gravity, medium gravity, or high gravity. And if it's high gravity, then the chances of disproportionality aren't going to be there. But if it's low gravity, then the disproportionality may kick in. But we don't know what went on. So there's a problem there as far as the reporting is concerned. As far as the name suppression issue is concerned, the court would have to be satisfied that the publication of this young person's name would have resulted in extreme hardship. But once again, because it hasn't been reported properly, the arguments about extreme hardship and so on and so forth have not been properly canvassed in the media. So the public has not been informed. And this is the problem. Court reporting in this country is appalling. It is absolutely disgraceful. Public Interest Journalism Fund to assist court reporting notwithstanding. On the whole, court reporting is not good. And this is one case where the public should have had better information and they haven't.
As far as the information is concerned, I remember in the first few weeks, actually, of RCR's existence, I was producing a show for Chantelle Baker, and we did a whole show about this, about the Posy Parker incident. And we spent the week looking through all of the media coverage leading up to that event, and it really seemed like the whole thing was incited by the media. It started very early on in the week, and it just kept on snowballing and snowballing, to the point where this was just an explosion, where this young man punched this woman in the face three times, wasn't it? So the media have covered it a hell of a lot. It just seems disproportionate the way that they're following up on it here.
They didn't cover it in court. They didn't cover the court outcome.
No, they covered it. They covered it wall to wall when it happened. But yeah, ever since then, it's just been completely ignored, hasn't it?
Well, I've always been of the view, because, you know, I've sat in courts where somebody's been brought before the court on a particularly serious charge, generally where there's been blood in the gutter or something like that, and the place has been overflowing with media, and there are applications for cameras in court and photographs and all sorts of stuff, and then name suppression and all the rest of it. But that's on a first appearance. And then when the case finally gets resolved, Where's the media? Nobody's there, because most of the people who report the courts have got the attention span of a gnat. And that's really is about what it's all about. It's not good.
Alistair, certainly Sean Plunkett on the platform the other day pointed the finger at the media and said that they had raised the temperature on this matter so far that it was almost incitement to violence, and that they deserve to take some of the blame for what happened in regard to this young man's situation in court.
And the other part of the name suppression excuse me story is that, of course, Kelly J. Keene, aka Posey Parker, has reportedly named this young man on a social media account, except she didn't. I saw the at Posey Parker account, and the name, she put the photo of the young guy up, but his name was a complete mishmash of what his real name is. So I know what his real name is because it didn't take me long to find out, but the name that she put up was not his name at all. So again, it's just, it's weirder and weirder, as somebody once said.
Also talking about weirder and weirder, there's Stuff's infatuation with Reality Check Radio. There was a hit piece on this last week. John, I want to bring you in on this one, talking about universities and champions of diversity. Yet for some reason, RCR is not part of this inclusiveness agenda. They don't seem to want us.
Well, I guess it's pretty understandable, Alistair, because the views coming through from RCR tend to run counter to a critical social justice narrative, which is the dominant narrative in the mainstream media. And I think it's very easy for us to be given some pretty unpleasant labels. But I just feel that RCR does an incredibly important job at the moment, because it is vital that we get more balance in these views that are put in front of the public. I mean, there's some very strange stuff happening. I was reading Lionel Shriver in The Spectator a couple of days ago. She had done this article on Google Gemini, the AI application, and how it was presenting a Viking warrior as a black woman. The Pope, when asked for a picture of the Pope, it presented a dark skin coloured female. The astonishing things that are occurring to encourage us all to change our thinking at the moment really do need some counterfactual, some rational discussion. It's unfortunate that such discussions tend to involve older white guys who are automatically cancelled and should be disregarded in the new order. But I think we've got to keep talking, and we've got to keep the conversation rational, because the moment we start shouting at each other, we really have lost the battle a bit. And some constructive discourse is what's needed in New Zealand right now to get us back into a more harmonious state as a country, I think.
So perhaps the diversity of views.
Yes.
The comment about the old white man that John mentioned was that I was at a conference once where I was classified as an old privileged white man. And I was able to turn that around because I said to the speaker, "Congratulations, you've managed to get four discriminatory categories into the one sentence." And that prompted some amusement from the audience. But if this old white man, and with a certain degree of privilege, can comment on this, on the issue, I think that I've written this, and I'll read out what I've written. I'm going to put it up on Substack next week. At the time when there are some very real concerns about the future of mainstream news media in New Zealand following the demise of News Hub, the rise of alternative sources of information such as Reality Check Radio and The Platform must cause some concern to mainstream media outlets. This is exacerbated by the fact that public confidence in mainstream media has been declining for some time, yet The Platform was able to announce that it had more YouTube subscribers than Stuff in less than 2 years since starting operation. Clearly, that must send a message. It seems to me that the demonization of alternative media outlets like RCR, and to a lesser degree the platform, arises from three things. The first is jealousy of the new kids on the block who are sucking audiences and eyeballs away from establishment media. The second is that online radio like RCR and the platform demonstrate the available alternatives to the monolithic model used by mainstream media. They use a completely distributed model for both creation and distribution of content, which avoids the necessity and expense of centralized premises, offices, and technology. These new platforms haven't got it completely right, but they understand the potential of the new technology and its disruptive capabilities better than mainstream media, and the medium is at least as important as the message, if not more so. The third is that these outlets are putting forward a narrative that is alternative to that of mainstream media, and that is something that mainstream media, who has occupied pole position in the information industry for so long, cannot stand. So calling out reality check radio as whack conspiracy theorists is one way of achieving an objective. And my thinking about stuff and mainstream media in general is that the objective that they are after is for mainstream media to be the only voice in the room.
Alistair, I just want to say on this topic 17 words. There is no such thing as bad publicity, just as long as they spell your name right.
I think that those two statements are a great place for us to end this. I do have one last question for you all, though. Before next week's show, will we see another closure or round of layoffs? And you get an extra bonus point if you can name who it's going to be.
I think there's probably more to come from TVNZ.
John?
Yes, I think there's more to come, Alistair. And I think the viewer figures for the alternatives are going to keep going up. They're going up by 10,000 every 10 days on Sky News Australia at the moment.
Well, I'll tell you one place where there won't be redundancies, and that's Radio New Zealand. Haven't they just doubled their income through a Labor government grant from last year? So they're going to go from strength to strength. A great graph appeared on KiwiBlog this morning, which showed media income, a series of graphs of the various media organisations. TVNZ's was dropping. The only one, a red line, funnily enough, a red line for Radio New Zealand just went up and up and up and up. And it's all yours and my taxpayer money that's going towards it.
Okay, that's it for us this week. Thank you very much for joining us, Peter Williams, David Harvey, and John Rain. And thank you to all our RCR listeners. My name's Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to The Fourth Estate only on Reality Check Radio.
Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.